Hi, I'm Daniel Lenzian, host of Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studios. Western New York Soundstage is a podcast that looks to explore Western New York's creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. Today, I speak with actor and comedian Paul Reiser. Reiser's filmography is an impressive list of cultural touchstones, from Barry Levinson's Diner to Ridley Scott's Aliens, Beverly Hills Cop, the sitcom My Two Dads, and the sitcom Mad About You, for which he was a producer, Whiplash, Fosse Verdon, The Kominsky Method, The Boys on Amazon, and the worldwide smash hit Stranger Things. Now, in addition to all this film work, Reiser has written four books, including Couplehood, Familyhood, and Babyhood. He has been a stand-up comic for over 40 years and is bringing his unique style of observational humor to the Buffalo State Performing Arts Center on Friday, March 17, 2023 at 8 p.m. This was a special interview for me because I remember watching Mad About You with my family from childhood. The Paul Reiser that I remember from that show was affable, funny, approachable, and quick. And that is exactly who I met during this interview. He was generous with his time and answers, especially about the craft of comedy and the importance of testing out material. Please enjoy this interview with Paul Reiser and go to the link in the show notes for tickets to his show. Paul, thank you so much for meeting with me today. It is great to connect with you.
And you. A pleasure to be here in beautiful Buffalo podcast land.
Thank you. Well, I understand you've been to Buffalo before. Is there anything that you hope to do or hope to accomplish while you're in the city?
What would be great is if we get laughs at the show. That is my goal. To miss that goal would be sad, to be honest. You know what? I have not been there in a long time. I always say, I went to school in Binghamton, which is for the school for people who just didn't have what it took to get all the way to Buffalo. Who just didn't have the stamina to drive the extra 4 hours, didn't have the grades, and also were just a little afraid of snow.
Gotcha. You know, in my research, I saw that you went to Stuyvesant High School. My sister used to teach at Stuyvesant High School and went to SUNY Binghamton. I teach at SUNY Fredonia. So it's really great to have sort of a product of the SUNY system. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Now, when did your sister teach at Stuyvesant?
Oh, in sort of the later 2000s, you know, the early sort of mid-2000s. So you would have been gone by then. But
oh, I was well gone.
But I'm sure the golden step with your name on it is still there.
Oh, that is there. The kids touch it every day on the way to labs.
I know that you studied piano in college. Is there a connection between music and comedy? I know that you've released an album and that a lot of sort of famous comedians are musicians. Do you think that there's a connection between the two?
No, not really. A lot of comedians also eat sandwiches, but I don't know that there's a connection between eating and no, you know, I mean, if you, to get really poetic about it, yeah, there are rhythms and phrasings and things that are common in music and comedy. But, you know, to me, they were never, not only were they not overlapped, they were almost deliberately separate. Police says, why don't you play piano on your show? I said, because they have nothing to do with each other. And they're almost, for me, they're really yin yang. I mean, comedy is one energy level and my music, I actually almost always listen to and play strikingly sad, melancholy stuff, the opposite of comedy. In fact, the album that I did with this wonderful singer, Julia Fordham, we called the album Unusual Suspects, but the original title that I wanted is Why So Sad? Because they're just 10 really depressing songs, which is surprising for two very happy people. But yeah, I'm actually always drawn to very emotional, sad music. Well, sad, emotional.
Yeah, deep, right. Well, I mean, speaking of sort of emotional, people must get emotional when they see you because you must be recognized all the time. Your work has an intergenerational appeal. You mean a lot to a lot of people. You're really funny. You seem really approachable. You must be recognized now for all different kinds of projects.
It has certainly changed in the last couple of years that if somebody comes over with a smile on their face and they're under 30, I know that they're Stranger Things fans. If somebody with a tattoo comes over, I know he watches The Boys. anybody older in the 60s and 70s, that's a Kaminsky method. You know, it has changed for sure. And I see it in the audiences, you know, people come to my live show. It's the demographic has widened, which is nice. But I have to say, you know, I never really aim. I just talk about what I talk about, which is my life. And it's stuff that's probably age appropriate to me. But I'm finding that it works for everybody. You know, the 20 and 30 year olds are not leaving going, "Hey man, I didn't get any of that." I will say once in a while, people will bring their 8 year old, their 10 year old, and they just look at like, "I don't know what I'm looking at." You know, somebody brought an 8 year old, a particularly tiny 8 year old to a show and sat in the front row. And I just couldn't help but keep seeing this poor kid. This is not going to be funny to you. Or I don't know that anything is funny. You know, any presentational comedy is funny to an 8 year old. But yeah, it has been widening and growing, and it's been fun. And I see the audience is getting bigger, you know, which is nice.
That's great. You have such a keen sense for choosing projects and materials like Aliens, Beverly Hills Cop, Mad About You, Whiplash, Stranger Things, The Kaminsky Method, and The Boys. Where did this great knack for scripts and characters come from? How do you choose them?
You know, Mad About You, you know, I created for myself and it sort of grew out of my stand-up. So that was easy. I got that job easily because as a producer, I already liked me. And, you know, you get scripts and I've been in a really fortunate position that I don't have to go and do things that don't appeal to me. And there's no real plan. I think things just come up. You know, I remember getting a call for Whiplash and I read this script and I thought, and I saw a little demonstration, a sample reel that he made, like an 18-minute version of the film. And I thought it was brilliant. And I thought, well, this is going to be great. And it wasn't a big role, but it was like a beautiful film. And he was clearly going to be a great filmmaker. They all happened for different ways. Kaminsky Method happened because I knew Chuck Lorre, who created the show, was an old friend. And I literally just called him to congratulate him after I saw the first season. It was just so well done and so different than what he's known for. I jokingly said, "Come on, let's see, let me do a show like that." I said, "Two old guys sitting in a car, I could do that all day." And he said, "Well, it's funny you should say that. Do you want to come on this show?" I went, "Yes, please." And he had in mind this character already in his head for the second season. So I don't know that he would have called me because I think he was obviously thinking of somebody older. But because I called, he went, "Well, wait a second, we could age you up. We could make you heavier than you are and balder than you are." You know, so you never know. It's funny, The Boys, that was a surprising amount of attention that I got and a whole different audience. And I was only in a little bit of two episodes, but I had never heard of the show when I got the invitation to come join. My 22-year-old son, who's the cultural aficionado in my house, he knows everything. And so I said, "Have you heard of the show, The Boys? They want me to be on it." And he went, "It's great and you'll hate it." I went, "Interesting selling point." But then I watched it. I went, "Oh, I know what he's, I get it. I mean, it's so over the top." But when I realized it's not trying for shock value, or it is deliberately and very consciously over the top in a very funny, grotesque, but funny, smart way. So I had a great time on that. So, you know, they all happen for different reasons and they come up in surprising ways. You know, I got Reboot came up just, they were already about to shoot it and I got the script and went, "Well, this is great." And it happened to fit in a window. I was heading off in the summer. I was making this movie that I wrote and produced. And I said, "Well, I can't interfere with the movie." And they said, "Well, we'll get you out in time." I went, "Okay, let's do it." So I've been really lucky and they've all been fun. All been fun shows to do.
I have to tell you, I teach a class before this and I mentioned to my students that I would be speaking with you and they looked you up and said, "Oh my God, he's the one from Whiplash." And they were so, and I was surprised that they didn't say The Boys or anything like that, but that's what they immediately connected with.
What do you teach?
I'm a theater professor at Fredonia State University. So I teach theater.
Theater professor and the kids knew Whiplash. Interesting. Yeah, well, I think Whiplash did, you know, was such a great film and it was a pretty big hit, but people who saw it were really impacted by it. And I think for performers, you know, musicians and actors and theater people, it's not surprising because we've all had some teacher that wasn't necessarily J.K. Simmons, but was somewhat of a figurehead, an authority. You know, I had a music professor, a piano professor in college who I loved, and he was not much. I was 18 and he was 27, but he was sort of a young, new, flashy guy, but he was a great teacher. And we've become friends. We're still friends. I just actually saw him recently and had my second piano lesson in the last 40 years. But it was funny to me that I had, in seeing him and sitting down and playing what I had prepared, And it was totally obvious. I'm not in school and we're friends. And I just said, well, let me know what you think and what can I do better? But I felt this old muscle twitch in my DNA of, oh boy, I hope the teacher likes me. It's like, that's such a part of the teacher-student relationship, especially in the arts where you care more about it. You know, you care more about what you're writing or playing or performing than you might a biology class. I mean, I never had, he was not at all like the whiplash. The nerve muscles and the sense memory of that relationship that was a whiplash, certainly I think present in all of us who had cared about whatever it is we were doing.
Definitely is important to them. So you've made an impact. You've made an impact. You've worked across all media, film, television, live performance. Do you have a favorite performance medium and why?
Interesting question. Yeah, you know, people don't believe it when I say it, but like stand-up is the thing that I love doing. And I've never done a lot of theater. And if I look back, I think part of, you know, whatever, elementary school, or if I was in a school play, it wasn't that I loved theater, that I loved character or storytelling. It's like, I just wanted to be performing. I just wanted to be funny. So it wasn't until I was in high school, I said, like, oh, I mean, I always loved comedians, but I didn't think about, like, that's a possibility. And then when I was in high school and college, for sure, there was suddenly a world that was made possible, like these new things called comedy clubs. You go there and whatever is going to happen can happen from there. That's the thing I love doing. And so to be on something like Stranger Things, which is a global phenomenon, the likes of which is really rare. It doesn't happen that big. So, you know, that I can go to another country and people go, oh, strange, Dr. Owens. I'm like, wow, that's a big show. You know, Mad About You totally was a new world that put us in the homes of millions and millions of people every week. That's a new level of success, and it's great. And actually, you know, I had a great time. You know, Mad About You was a great experience, and I loved the people we worked with, and we loved going to work, and we couldn't wait to write new shows. And so I loved every part of it, but it's intense. There were grueling hours, and anytime you're doing a TV show, you have partners and authorities. You have studios that you hope will pick you up, they hope will buy your show. You have networks that you hope will promote the show, and then you hope it, you know, you the audience go see it. In stand-up, all of that is eliminated, and you just, it's you. So I sit down, and the risk is mine, the reward is mine. But the fun is like, well, I'll sit down, and something strikes me funny, let me write it down. Let me go on stage in a local club. Let me play with it and let me finesse it until it's funny and presentable. And it's always growing and it's always changing. But the lack of middlemen, the lack of complications and the immediacy, you don't have to wait 10 months, 15 months to find out if it's funny. You find out every sentence if you're funny or if it's funny. And just also seeing the live people, you know, they're right there. And it's not even like theater. Yes, there's theater people, but you have to have a wall between you and them. Stand up. There's no wall. It's like, I can see you and it changes because of what the audience does. So that to me is really the most fun. What a long answer. My gosh, you look older than when you asked me that question.
I think it's just the lighting, but no, it was a great answer and thank you. And you know, I think it'll resonate with a lot of people. I mean, it kind of brings me to my next question, which is, so performing live can be such a big commitment. I think it's amazing that you're out there and doing it. I think that people in Buffalo are going to be really excited to see you. Is that what keeps you kind of motivated and keeping moving forward in terms of live performance and comedy?
Is what motivates?
Like, just like your love of it or the connection you have with the audience?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when I had taken a long time off from performing, not really meaning to and not calculating, but like in the early 90s when Mad About You started, I was just consumed with that. And when it was done, I was really content and hungry to stay home. And we had a new baby, we had a new house. And it's like, I just wanted to chill. And I got really good at that. So I would write things and I would write things from my house and I would do a project here and there, but it was basically off the radar. When I finally did go back and dip my toe in the water, I did what I did when I started, when I was 18, went into the comedy clubs and go on stage. It was different, admittedly, because audiences knew me and they were happy to see me. But that excitement lasts 12 seconds. And then they look at you like, okay, what did you want to tell us? And I go, oh, I don't have that. I just wanted to go. But what I remember was so striking is I'd go into the clubs and there'd be all the younger comics. Some were on their way up, some were well established, but I didn't never heard of them because I had not really been following it. But the younger comics, and they were looking at me, oh gee, Paul, what are you doing here on a Tuesday night for 45 people getting warming up for an HBO special or Netflix special? No. And I go, are you doing a Tonight Show spot? I went, no. And so why are you here? And I would say, because this is how you do it. And I remember my kids, you know, this is like 10 years ago, and I wasn't going out at night. Suddenly I'm going out at 7 o'clock. And where are you going? Going to this club. Why? I'm just going to work on material. I remember my son said, are they paying you? I went, no, they're not paying me. And they go, why are you doing it? I went, because this is how you do it. And I remember thinking of it as a teaching moment for my son. It's like, whatever you do, the way you do it is to do it. You just do it and you get better. I don't know what I did the first month or two that I went up on stage, 5 minutes of stuff. And it wasn't the material that was the challenge. It was the confidence and the muscle. The muscle had sort of atrophied. And I also thought, I don't know what I'm, they're looking at me funny. But it took, I would say, a solid year for me to get the muscle back and the brain. You know, the muscle is the brain. Well, it's also the body, the performing and the energy of performing. But the brain neurons firing like, okay, I can take that and go into that joke and I can do that. That muscle, if you don't use it, gets soft. So it took me a solid year before I felt confident enough to go out and, you know, try and sell a ticket and have people come see me. And I've been doing this, it's been like 10 years now. And I see the audience is getting bigger and I feel myself getting better at it, but you never get perfect at it. And a joke that worked great yesterday doesn't necessarily work great tonight. You're like, oh, why? And then you chase that and it's like keeping 27 balls in the air juggling at the same time. It's like, you're never going to get them all, but that's the fun of it.
Yeah, that tightrope walk. I'm so excited that you're able to share this with Buffalo on the 17th. What can people expect when they come and see you?
You know, I always have a hard time answering that. And the best I can describe it, I tell people, if you've seen Cirque du Soleil, my show is the opposite of that. Whatever it is you like out of Cirque du Soleil, you won't see it in my show.
No mask fans or things like that, they should stay home.
None of me folding myself up to fit into a shoebox. None of that will transpire. But other things will. But I do tell people, I say, you know, come to the show. If you're even thinking you're going to have a good, and I promise you, if you don't have a great time, and I'm pretty confident you will, but if for some reason you're not fully satisfied, I'll come back to Buffalo next year and I'll take you to see somebody much funnier. So there's really no way to lose. You know what I'm saying?
That is true. This is my final question for us today. You've made a real effort to keep comedy as a part of your life and your artistic practice, even in our interview today. Why is laughter so important?
It just is, you know, it is a biological thing, like hunger and thirst. It's like laughing it's a natural thing. I don't think it was invented on purpose. It was invented because it just happened. And like somebody fell and somebody else laughed. And I go, that's really funny how the guy fell. I don't know why somebody else falling. Mel Brooks used to say the difference between comedy and drama is like, drama is if I get a paper cut, I'm going to cry and I go to emergency. Well, comedy is if you fall in a hole and die. He goes, that's funny. So, you know, it's one of those things that you shouldn't look too closely at why, just enjoy it. And I find, you know, people say, what do you talk about? And I always said, I'm not actually smart enough to make anything up. I only know how to talk about what actually happened in my house with my marriage, my kids, my neighbors, me getting older, me trying to figure out the world. And when people are laughing, it's not because I'm such a genius. They're laughing because they're going, oh man, that sounds like my house. And there is something really wonderful about that sense of community. You know, people we're all sitting in this theater together. We're all laughing at the same thing because we all have this in common. That's a good way to spend an evening.
I would agree.
I think.
Absolutely. Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, that's everything I've ever thought of in one articulate little paragraph.
That's fantastic. I'm glad we got it all on the 25 minutes we had today.
There you go.
Great.
All right, man. Well, thank you.
Well, it's very nice to meet you.
Your job is to fill that theater. If I see an empty seat, I'm calling you at home in the middle of the night.
Well, we're going to fill it for you. Thank you, Paul. It was great to speak with you. And you. Take care.
All right, man. Thanks, Daniel.
Well, that is our show for today. It was great to speak to Paul Reiser, and I can't wait to see his show at Buffalo State University on Friday, March 17th at 8 p.m. For tickets, please go to the show notes. Special thanks to Andrew Binder from Buffalo State Performing Arts Center. Today's show is produced by Jessica Marinelli. Addison Schoonmacher engineered the episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show. If you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. We'll be back soon with more episodes, where we will explore our local creative economy through a series of conversations with artists, musicians, producers, directors, and authors from Western New York and beyond. In addition to this podcast, you can check out our local event guides on buffalorising.com. Thanks for listening to Western New York Soundstage from Buffalo Rising and Local Matters Studio. We'll be back soon with more episodes.